John Heron for AM 1290.
Good afternoon and welcome to another edition of Money Talk. I'm Neil Kreisel, and Diane Duva and I are your hosts every week right here on AM 1290, repeated at 11, and on Saturdays at 6. We're brought to you by Broadview Mortgage, whose highly trained and experienced team takes great pride in helping people with home financing, offering competitive rates and a wide array of loan programs. And Arnaldi's Cafe, one of Santa Barbara's oldest and most intimate restaurants since 1937, located on the corner of Olive and Cota Streets in downtown Santa Barbara. And Arlington Financial Advisors, a leading wealth management firm in Santa Barbara, providing its clients with the personal care and attention of a small independent firm, coupled with the vast resources of a major financial institution.
Hi, Neil. How are you doing today?
Hi, Diane. I have a big surprise for you. We have my favorite guests on today.
We do. I know. We are your favorite.
We are our favorites. The guests today are Diane and I. And it's just so nice to just spend time with you alone. Excuse me, and Richard, our engineer.
I'm like there are other people in the studio.
That's a good point. So let's talk about a lot of things.
Yeah, so today we're going to start off with the front page of the Pacific Coast Business Times, keeping it local. The article by Joshua Molina about Amazon puts the squeeze on State Street and really talking about the vacancy rate that's going on State Street. I was at a dinner party on Saturday night where it really dominated the conversation of how are we going to overcome the vacancy issue that's happening on State Street and, you know, bring back Santa Barbara as what Santa Barbara has been all these years? And so what this article actually talks about is how, you know, there are even more stores on the block on State Street that are looking to close. Off Saks Fifth Avenue is getting ready to close. Macy's just recently closed. Bucatini, Blush, you know, Bucatini, I think, gosh, I've been here since 98 and Bucatini has been here the whole time. So that's really affecting the feel and location of the town, but also affecting the sales tax. And so the city council is looking to put on the ballot in November a 1% sales tax increase, which is significant. And I'm not sure that the online avenue is going to slow down anytime soon, because what we've basically turned into is a discount retailers and a T-shirt shop. But I think it's worth noting in Josh's article that Frank Kochkis, one of our city councilmen, said, you know, transients, at least on State Street, add to the problem. Ultimately, it comes down to dollars and cents. So rents will probably have to adjust downward. But that will be a function of the market, he says. But when I speak to my friends in commercial real estate, they're really concerned because we have a situation in Santa Barbara where many of the landlords don't require the rents to make it. So they buy these commercial real estate buildings, and yes, they want to make money, but it's not a necessity like it is with some real estate investors. And so I think it will take a little bit longer than in other markets for the rents to adjust downward, but it does seem that, you know, we are experiencing the brunt of this problem, and it's a nationwide problem, because a companion piece to this article that was in the Pacific Coast Business Times was also in the Wall Street Journal talking about three difficult lessons for traditional retailers by Christopher Mims in today's Wall Street Journal. And it's really focusing on data and saying the only way that the brick and mortar stores are going to compete with the likes of Amazon in the online world is to really make sure that they're using their data smartly. So if you think about it this way, when you go online to shop at Amazon, it's remembering all the things that you bought. And so really making it more personalized. You know, in the article, it says Unilever might buy store sales data to figure out which products are in high demand and when people buy them. So it's something that the brick and mortar stores are doing, but they're just not using it for their own purposes. And really what they need to start doing is personalize the customer experience and automate it to make it more profitable. And this article goes on to say that legacy technology isn't going to cut it. They're going to need to sink some serious dollars into how to make an online, offline experience for the customer much more user-friendly.
The comment you made before, which I think is really important, that the ownership is not necessarily looking to maximize profits, but there are many owners in town that almost consider owning these buildings as a trophy.
They look at it as a safe place to park some money, some investment dollars that diversifies out their portfolio.
And the reason I bring this, highlight this, is that in the 1970s, New York's Fifth Avenue was really going down the drain. And this is really surprising if you consider the rents now and who's on Fifth Avenue. And one of the things they discovered when they looked into it is that at least one store on each block between 57th Street and 42nd Street was a bank. And what banks do is they basically present cold space because you can't window shop. And so they actually, the government intervened and basically said you can't put any more banks on Fifth Avenue. And besides the economy improving, by not permitting anyone to put banks on Fifth Avenue, they began to put more stores, and stores resulted in a better shopping experience because you weren't looking at basically covered up windows. And it may be that there's going to have to be some sort of government intervention because in Santa Barbara, because, and I, this gets back to the homeless problem, I'm as liberal as anyone, and I don't think that the homeless people should be, the whole homeless issue should be put under the carpet. But part of bricks and mortar shopping is the experience of walking down the street and just window shopping. And the homeless problem has become a distraction, and it reduces the experience. And so if there are alternatives to shopping on State Street because it's not a relaxing endeavor, people will go to alternatives, including the web. So this issue of the panhandling and some of the behavior of some of the homeless people in front of stores, which not simply hurts the business in the front of the store, but also dissuades some people, I think, to come down and just walk around.
Absolutely. And, you know, the homeless issue, I think, has gotten better. The police have addressed it in a way that they have now community policing, which is a new concept or newish in the last year or so. But, if there aren't stores there to begin with, I think there's something like 45 vacancies. And our shopping corridor is getting longer with the La Entrada project coming online with a bunch of retail underneath that. I don't see a good solution to this issue that Santa Barbara's facing.
I'd like to discuss an article that was in the Wall Street Journal that was not totally surprising, but much more dramatic than I thought. And that was that just 10 stocks in the S&P 500, and obviously the S&P 500 has 500 stocks, 10 stocks accounted for 53% of this year's 4.7% gain. And it has, to me, a great deal of implication for the idea that you can pick stocks. Now, of course, if you picked any of those 10 stocks...
I pointed out to you at lunch, if you picked the top 10 stocks, you'd be looking like a rock star.
Right, but you would have had to pass through the other 490 stocks. And so, and by the way, this is not that unique. There have been... many, many periods in the last 75 years where very few stocks have accounted for a majority of the gains. And for me, it just tells you how difficult it is to be a stock picker and how difficult it is to beat the market when so few stocks actually beat the market.
Absolutely. It goes back to diversification. And you don't know what 10 stocks are going to beat the market. And so you need to have a little bit of money in all the baskets. The S&P 500, you need to go international. I don't think that it's a wise decision to invest in a sole or be a stock picker and pick four or five companies and expect your return to rival that of the S&P 500 as a basket.
Yeah, and one of the problems that many people find themselves doing is they read an article like this and they buy one or two or three of those 10 stocks, which is probably the worst time to buy them now that they've outperformed the market.
Right, and then especially a company like Apple, which is the largest company measured by market capitalization in the S&P 500 index, you know, it's had a several year over year large gain. And now people start to get comfortable with it and they start to buy it. And so it's one of those things where you just need to really be careful. So, you know, the next article that we have was also, well, maybe we should do the super savers. That some people have the discipline to set a savings plan and stick with it. But as a diet, occasionally indulgences are needed to make it sustainable. And so we, Neil and I, have discussed this article a few times, and
the page is already yellow.
The page is already yellow. And really it's talking about people that kind of go to an extreme. Instead of just saving to save into your 401k, they're denying their living. That's basically what this article is saying. And that people need to start living in the day and saving for the future. So it's a delicate balance, which is why it's often helpful to, you know, really work with somebody to help get a gauge on where you are relative to other people, your age, in your income bracket. And when it says, you know, the CFA designation, which stands for the Chartered Financial Analyst Institute, which administers this CFA designation, recently put out a list of 20 mistakes people make with investing. And the top one was expecting too much or using someone else's expectations in retirement. Or in other words, not having a sense of what you want to achieve. So first and foremost, the people who achieve their goals set a goal. And I think that that's what's important in this article, is that you set that goal and you actually work towards the goal and make sure that it's something that adds meaning to your life.
And I think one of the takeaways is very similar to how you should nourish yourself. One of the things that is true for just about everything in life is not to do something in excess. And so if you become, as the article said, a super saver, that means you should make a lot of money and live in a one-room apartment eating out of canned tuna fish so that you can have a good time when you're 70 years old, that may be a little bit excessive.
Right. And it's
of course, I did that, but I am excessive.
You are excessive, but excessive. That's beside the point. But it's true, because oftentimes people, you get into a mindset, which we talk about in another article later on in this show, is you get into a mindset and you just start saving and saving and saving. And it's important to know what you're saving for. Just like you often say, you know, why are you investing? What's the purpose behind it? Is it just to, you know, die with the most money in the bank, or is it to actually live the very best life that you're looking to live?
And we will come back with the answer to that question and the question of the meaning of life. You're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back.
For prospective homebuyers, one of the most important steps of the loan process is getting clear and honest information from someone who will speak plainly and truthfully about loan programs and options.
Hello, I'm Kelly Marsh, the branch manager of Broadview Mortgage in Santa Barbara, where our highly skilled and experienced team takes great pride in helping clients obtain home financing with honest, knowledgeable, fast, friendly, and efficient service. As a Santa Barbara area native who has spent the past 19 years in the mortgage industry and has closed over 4,000 loans, I'd appreciate the opportunity to earn your business and invite you to visit broadviewsb.com or call my office at 805-563-1100 to learn more about how Broadview Mortgage can help you determine the best way to manage mortgage debt to achieve a more stable financial future.
Licensed by the Department of Business Oversight under the California Residential Mortgage Lending Act, license number 813G136, NMLS number 170528, an equal housing lender.
Star Jasmine Music serves over 3,600 people per year. By providing a safe, supportive environment to explore music, you'll find a place that resonates within. We teach songwriting and how to play a variety of instruments. We have a Pro Tools state-of-the-art recording facility and provide opportunities for teens and young adults who show passion for music and demonstrate talent to record their work. This experience has been known to better one's self-esteem and often leads to development of skills in business and self-management. We have special programs for at-risk youth, as well as the mentally and physically challenged. When ready after a 10-week series, we record our students and give them a CD to show the fruit of their efforts. This experience leads to self-confidence. Visit us at www.starjasminemusic.org. Star Jasmine Music, sharing music exploration through teaching and recording.
Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Broadview Mortgage. Since 1988, a mortgage banker and direct lender that believes in providing in-depth loan consulting to its customers in a personalized and honest manner.
In case you missed our show 2 weeks ago, Kelly was on and gave us great perspective in terms of the loan process and how it all works.
I just found an interesting article. I don't have it with me, but I was surprised that mortgage rates went back down.
They have gone back down. She said that 2 weeks ago.
I wasn't listening.
Here, it's on. It, you know what? If you're listening right now and you want to listen to previous shows recorded, we have a podcast on iTunes. Go to Money Talk 1290 and check it out. So the next article we're going to talk about is very relevant to today. The French vote calms EU fears on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, as well as on the front page of the news press, I think. But the good news for the markets, as the market responded positively today, is that a centrist, Emmanuel Macron, is...
Well, that was very good.
Very good. You want to know something funny? What? 2 weeks ago, a friend that I hadn't seen in 25 years from Belgium came to visit. And he was very disappointed that I could no longer speak French. But anywho, back to the vote. The centrist has actually... It looks as if he has a high probability of winning against the far right Marine Le Pen, and their runoff is on May 7th. And so, based upon the way the markets are reacting, it's looking as if the centrist candidate, who is much for keeping the EU intact instead of breaking it apart, as Miss Le Pen would like to do. Is good for the markets.
Yeah, what happened last week is the euro went down in anticipation of the runoff being between Le Pen and the left-wing extremist. And either one of those, for different reasons, would have resulted in France withdrawing from the EU. And so the idea now that you have a centrist and Le Pen running, the bet is that the centrists will win, and as a result, the euro gained dramatically today, and the stock market was up dramatically today as well.
You know, what's interesting about that, though, is how much credence we're giving these polls when they were so wrong in the U.S. election, and whether or not it will come to fruition, the polls, given that every poll had Hillary Clinton beating Donald Trump, and here we are with a Donald Trump administration.
Well, actually, she did beat Donald Trump, and the polls don't look at necessarily the national big poll didn't look at state by state, and so she did win by 3.5 million votes. So, in that sense, the polls were right. The next article we have is really a dramatic headline: Vanguard is growing faster than everybody else combined, and the Vanguard funds last year. In the last 3 years, grew by $823 billion. The other 4,000 funds in the country grew by only $97 billion. So basically, Vanguard grew eight times faster than the entire fund industry.
And what's interesting, I think, to note with Vanguard is that Vanguard is actually owned by its funds.
That's correct. And one of the problems with Vanguard is because they're owned by the fund holders, they've taken a view that they have a responsibility to keep costs down. And they have. Cost of management in 1976 for a Vanguard fund was 0.7%, 0.701%. Today, it's fallen to 0.12%. And in fact, and this is an incredible statistic, that if you divide the assets under management by the number of employees, the per person
managed responsibility is $44 billion per person.
That's just astounding.
Yeah. And, of course, the other side of it is one of the complaints about Vanguard is they have the worst customer service. So is suffering.
Honestly, it's one of those things where I have a client right now who has accounts at Vanguard, and her spouse passed away, and she's trying to get them to update the cost basis. And it's this, they say they'll do it, and then they don't do it. And it's like, who's on first? No one's giving her any service at all.
And there's an interesting companion article to this. And it wasn't a companion, it's just a separate article in the Wall Street Journal that took a look at the real cost of an ETF. And as you noticed in this article, the cost of the ETF was the management fees. But this article explored the cost by looking at the price you pay for an ETF versus the underlying market value of the stocks in that basket. Now, just a quick review, the way an ETF works, the ETF, whether it's for the S&P 500 or for airline stocks or whatever, drug stocks, buys a basket of stocks for each shareholder equal to the value of all of the stocks that they have in the index. So one would assume that if you buy an ETF, let's say at $100, the value of the underlying stock should be $100. But that's not the case because it depends on how liquid those stocks are, how effective the company was in buying those stocks, because every day they go out to these ETF brokers and actually buy this basket of real stocks to represent all of the new purchases of the ETF. So to the extent that, let's say, you buy a ETF for $100, it may be that because of the timing of the purchases or because they had to pay a little bit more for the purchases, the actual value of those underlying assets could be greater or less than the amount that is that what you're paying for. So, for example, the article points out that sometimes there's a 1% or 2% difference, which could be either a premium or a discount versus in terms of what the cost of the ETF is versus what the underlying securities are, which is substantially, that 1%, 2% is substantially more than the management fees. So one of the things you have to watch out for, I'm not sure how you watch out for it. It's like a catcher telling the pitcher in a baseball game, strike them out. Thank you.
Captain Obvious.
Yeah. But this is something that wasn't obvious, that should be obvious, that you need to look more than just the management fees. You need to look at how effective the ETF is in buying stocks at the true value that the market value puts on that ETF.
Well, and I think, you know, part of it is ETFs are a relatively new investment vehicle. Many people before a decade ago had never, I don't even know when ETFs were created, but that said, they're relatively new.
Well, they've been created 35 years ago. The difference is they haven't been popular now. And the reason they've become so popular is because stock pickers have done so badly. So would you
And they're also, even if you look at an S&P 500 index mutual fund, they're a lot more efficient and less costly.
Right. And part of the reason for the proliferation is not only the people looking for alternate ways of investing, but the computerized trading and hedge fund businesses need to be able to go into the market and buy the market and sell the market and do all kinds of things. So there's a demand from this growing space of basically computerized artificial intelligence type training, which we'll be talking about in a little while. You're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back.
On the next episode of Recipes for Disaster.
So we've got our neighbor Paul coming over tonight for a barbecue, which is why I prepared a delicious lemon rosemary steak marinade from my special collection of old family recipes. To make sure the steaks are extra, extra, extra tender, I left them marinating out on the counter overnight, just like Nana used to.
Maria may mean well, but without food safety, it never ends well. Always thaw or marinate foods in the refrigerator at 40 degrees Fahrenheit or below, or you could make your friends and family really sick. Maria's neighbor Paul didn't think twice about the steak he ate until he was presenting his company's financial forecast to the board. That's when a sudden bout of food poisoning made it explicitly clear that profits weren't the only thing on the rise. Watch Recipes for Disaster at foodsafety.gov. you'll learn the right steps as Maria does everything wrong. Brought to you by the USDA, HHS, and the Ad Council.
Are you ready to start and run your own successful business? Ready to grow your small business or home business? Women's Economic Ventures is a local nonprofit helping women start and build successful businesses. In addition to their highly successful self-employment training program, Weave offers services to help women succeed at every stage of their business, from startup and launch to building and sustaining a business, including individual business counseling, professional networking events, advanced business training, and small business loans to start or expand a business. Over 1,000 local businesses are now owned and operated by women who have taken part in programs and services. Whether you're ready to start up, launch, build, or sustain your business, Women's Economic Ventures is right here to help you make it happen. Call 965-6073 or visit weaveonline.org.
Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Arlington Financial Advisors, a leading wealth management firm founded on providing thoughtful, objective, and comprehensive financial guidance for families and entities who are seeking long-term financial confidence.
Yes. So, and you want to know what? We're going to be playing bocce tonight at Arnaldi's. I will be there at 6.
Are there any tickets
left?
So
come join us. There are. Front row, actually.
Front row tickets. And you get a free meal if you...
Not free meal, but a $5 glass of wine or beer.
If they give you $5, you have to pay $5.
They don't hand you the $5 bill, but you could purchase one for
$5. I see. Okay.
New concept for you. New coupons.
So,
although, hey, based upon the last article, maybe that's what these brick and mortars need to start doing. Knowing how much beer and wine people drink, or beverage of choice, yours is what? A cappuccino?
Cappuccino.
And start sending you coupons for it.
You know, I always have cappuccino at lunch, and I was told that I am being gauche, that real aficionados do not have cappuccino past breakfast. So I have been insulted by a waitstaff person who thinks that I am not properly informed about what you should be doing at lunch. So I'm supposed to order a latte, I think, as opposed to a cappuccino. I'm not sure.
Well, good to know. I'll remind you of that next Monday when we're having lunch. So our next article that we're going to talk about is the biggest money mistakes people make decade by decade. And this was in the Wall Street Journal. And really, our relationship with money changes as we get older. But what happens is every new stage of life brings new financial strategies that we need to follow. Excuse me. And those strategies oftentimes cost people a lot of money and jeopardize their, you know, financial security. And the first one, and I see this often now especially, is in the 20s, playing it too safe. So when I sit down with, you know, new young professionals, they're often much more conservative than even, say, their grandparents. They look at money and they're just so concerned about making a mistake that they do not actually want to invest. Some of them want to invest similarly to a person in their 90s. You know, in terms of how much risk they're willing to take with the stock market. And part of it, I think, is their lack of knowledge about the stock market, but also their lack of ability to make decisions. And so in your 20s, you really want to be heavily investing. It takes a lot less dollars in your 20s to invest and make it on the other end for your retirement than it does if, say, you start in your 40s. You've lost all that time or compounding interest, if you will, on your money. So in your 20s, according to this article, they're saying that they are often choosing conservative portfolios and they feel like they don't know anything. And so they're investing as if they're close to death.
Isn't that true also because young people don't really think about retirement? It's just so far away. It's why they may be risk takers in other areas. They'll jump out of airplanes because they're not really fearful of being hurt.
Well, according to this article, they're saying it's because of their low financial literacy. Mm-hmm. And if you think about it, you know, you graduate high school in the United States, And if you're headed on a college track, there is zero financial literacy classes that you take. If you are on a track where you're going to be in a profession that doesn't require a college education, they may teach you how to balance a checkbook. But in either scenario, no matter what your life choices are for your career or your profession, you need to have a baseline knowledge of financial literacy. And if you don't, it makes you be more conservative or perhaps too aggressive, depending upon your viewpoint, if you don't understand.
So what do you do if somebody comes to you and says, save, I have all this student debt. How can I save?
I see that often where people in their late 20s now are really crippled by their, you know, couple hundred thousand dollars worth of student loans. And it's a matter of allocating how much you're saving for yourself versus how much you're paying off. Because what happens with a $200,000 debt, it's so much and the weight on these people's shoulders is so high. You need to make sure that you're allocating some for savings because they're in their 20s. They need to be saving in their 401k, no matter how much student loan debt there is. But they also need to start chipping away at the debt and making sure that they're really not taking on any more consumer debt. I see all too often that people pay too much towards their student loans and in turn can't afford their lives to live. And I don't mean an extravagant life. I just mean living in general. And they start to accumulate credit card debt. And really, once you have the student loans and then you add a layer of consumer debt, you know, a credit card debt plus your car payment, you know, basically they're working just to pay those debts off and there's no way for them to get ahead. So back to the article they're talking about in your 30s, what happens with people in their 30s is that they become overwhelmed with complexity. So they think that, you know, 30s is when you're supposed to be a quote unquote adult. And in the nowadays, we're starting to make huge life decisions like marriage and commitment and children in your 30s. And so these 30-somethings are trying to keep up with how much wealth their parents have and live as if the lifestyle they remember as kids. And what they're forgetting is that their parents now are much older and they've had a lot longer time to save for retirement, to save for their lifestyle, and they start living too large of a lifestyle. I often say that for every 10% increase in what your lifestyle is, it costs you about 50% more. So if you think about, I liken it to a bottle of wine. If you usually buy a $10 bottle of wine and you want to start buying more expensive wine, you're usually then jumping that category to $15 to $20, which is 50% more to get a marginally better bottle of wine. So a lot of it is when you do get your raises and from your pay or you start having more money, that you start saving it for yourself first, adding every raise or every increase in pay that you get, that you increase your 401k contribution to the maximum, so $18,000. That's the first step. Then you start paying down debt, perhaps more aggressively, depending upon your interest rate. If it's credit card debt, absolutely. If it's student loan debt, I normally say just let it amortize if you're at a favorable interest rate. That said, I have seen some doozies of interest rates. With student loan debt, you can only consolidate once. And I've seen some people consolidate at 7.5%, 8%. And pretty much once you have that student loan debt, there's no way to get out from underneath it. Bankruptcy doesn't absolve you from it. You pretty much are stuck with that rate. And it's almost a way, if you could refinance it into a home, if you had a home and refinance it, even if you don't get the tax deductibility of that debt, you're cutting your interest rate in half.
So are we going to stop at 30 or is there a 40 also?
Life doesn't stop at 30. So in your 40s, what the article is saying is by 40s, we tend to be about halfway through our working lives, just as bigger expenses enter the picture. Many financial advisors point to two in particular that can be rife with errors, the house and the children, which is so true. I often say at 40, if you find the house that you want, it's good for you to stretch for it, but not stretch to the point of where you have no money whatsoever. And the second is kids. You know, kids are expensive. There's no there's no mistaking that single people without kids end up with more money at the end. And then in your 50s.
Oh, wait. You know what? I think we should just keep the suspense.
Keep the suspense for
and
the 50s.
And I think we should come back after our break and talk about the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and the 110s.
Sounds good, Neil.
Okay. You're listening to Money Talk on the Santa Barbara News Press radio station, and we'll be right back.
It's a fact. Successful wealth management is built on strategies that focus on the big picture, take a long-term view, and establish deep and valued relationships. Hello, I'm Diane Duva, founding partner at Arlington Financial Advisors, Santa Barbara's trusted family guide, empowering you to make more informed and confident decisions. At Arlington Financial Advisors, we bring order and balance to your financial life by monitoring and managing risk so you can focus on your work, family, and enjoying the moment. We are a fully independent firm offering strategic financial planning, estate and tax planning, and private money management. Our plans and portfolios are handcrafted using a rigorous and disciplined approach, supported by a consistent yet highly personalized client experience. Our clients look to Arlington Financial Advisors as a home away from home, a comfortable place to protect what they've accomplished while they prepare for what comes next. Please visit arlingtonfinancialadvisors.com or call me, Diane Duva, at 805-699-7300.
Welcome back to The Dog Show. Up next, we have Satchmo. Satchmo is a member of the Shelter Pet Group.
That's right, a group known especially for their couch-snuggling, ball-chasing, face-licking, tail-wagging, backyard-hanging, and, of course, companionship.
And what breed would you say Satchmo is?
I'd have to go with maybe a Labish Terrier Hound Chihuahua-looking kind of mix.
Tremendous dog.
I'd also like to point out Satchmo's coloring, a white, gray, brown, black brindle. Simply marvelous.
You know, it's such a treat to watch a dog like this.
Now, let's see him in action.
Look how he makes eye contact with his person.
That's actually known as the treat stare.
How intuitive. And now he appears to be excitedly turning in circles.
Ah, the happy dance, so common with this group.
And finally, the loving face lick.
It's great how he just gets in there and, well, licks.
Fantastic. But really, the best way to know an amazing shelter pet like Satchmo is to meet one.
Visit theshelterpetproject.org today. Adopt.
Brought to you by Maddie's Fund, the Humane Society of the United States, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Arnaldi's Cafe, one of Santa Barbara's oldest and most intimate restaurants since 1937, located on the corner of Olive and Cota Street in downtown Santa Barbara. So we just finished the 40s.
Well, I have another thing to add on the 40s. The 40s is also that gap time where you are often faced with paying for college expenses for your children while caring for your aging parents in some capacity. And whether it be time or money, you're being spread really thin, and it makes the 40s, you know, a challenging time. Now, in the 50s, it's interesting because when people turn 50, they tend to all of a sudden look at everything and say, do I have enough to retire? And the nightmare scenario is when you don't have enough to retire in your 50s and you just are starting to realize that you didn't do enough planning to make it work. And as we start to age and the advances in modern, you know, medicine happen, and we're all living longer and longer, you know, we're basically looking at a 30 to 40 year life expectancy from 50s that you need to plan on. Now, not all of us will be fortunate enough to make it that long, but you need to plan on it because you don't know if that is your case. And also the 50s tend to be a time when the kids have now left the house. You start to live it up because this is the time where you're feeling young. You're traveling and booking extravagant trips because you haven't for so long with the kids. And so it's basically you really need to make sure you have enough, because if not, you don't have a lot of time to make it up. And so what 60s and beyond... Neil, I know you're waiting with bated breath for this category.
What do you mean 60s and beyond? There's no 60s, 70s, 80s.
You know,
it's just called 60s and beyond?
It just says 60s and beyond. It's not delegating. And so part of it is, as we age, our ability, our cognitive ability starts to slow. And many people in our country are taught that money is something that you don't share, even among family members. And so by not...
You mean discussing money, not sharing money. You mean discussing...
Discussing, yes. Right. Sharing the details about money. Yeah. Exactly. Discussing it. And so because we're living longer and longer, it's really imperative that at 60s and beyond that you start talking to your adult children about your finances, your wishes, because as you age and your capacities diminish, you want to make sure that you are not being taken advantage of. And it's really sad when I've seen in the past, I've had some clients that have been targeted by these fraudsters on the phone or some not charities, basically just a fraud, calling people and asking for money. And they're doing it because they're not understanding the differences. And so you really need to delegate and get, whether it be with your finances or with your medical, you need to make sure that you have another, your adult children helping you or a close younger family friend.
Now, what about a financial advisor? Wouldn't it make sense to have a financial advisor over your whole life so that there is an institutional history that goes along with your situation so that it's not just you or your husband or wife or maybe one child? There's an institution that really understands your situation.
Well, I would say it's less about the institution and more about a person. So a person that knows you, knows how you handle things and can red flag an issue. A great example is I have a client who, you know, has become more agitated over the years, and normal course of business has really started to make him really upset. And so because I've had this client for a long time, I also know their daughter. And so I have permission from the parents to speak about matters about the parents to the daughter. And so I called her up and I said, you know, hey, I just want to give you a heads up. I don't know what's going on, but it's really out of character for your father to be acting in this way. And you might just want to take a look at it. And as it turns out, I later learned that it's because her dad had pretty much stopped eating at regular intervals. And so he was suffering from low blood pressure, blood sugar, and really they've put him on a regimen of eating more regularly, you know, making it a family issue and really making him a happier person.
One of the good things about Arlington Financial is they not only take care of your finance, but they also act as physicians.
We don't, but it's a relationship-based world. And when you notice that somebody's acting in a uncharacteristic way, you want to make sure that they're being taken care of. And part of it is because we care and love our clients and want what's best for them.
Yeah, one of the other interesting things is that when you're in your 30s and 40s and begin to create some sort of estate, you tend to appoint an executor of your estate of either someone that you look up to or at worst, someone who's a peer. But as you get older and older, you may not want to think about that decision because you want to make sure that the person who's the executor of your will and therefore take care of your finances when you're gone is actually going to be around.
That is a great point because I see a lot of people when they're naming guardians for their children, they're naming their parents or they're naming their uncle or aunt. And I always say, you know, you want to think of that backup person that's your age or younger. And it's the same for your affairs, because if your executor of your estate is your same age, you're aging together. And it's better for you to make that switch to your adult children or a family friend that's younger so that they are there for you when you need them.
So this article that we're now going to discuss sort of is follows along some of the discussion we just had, and that is, it asks the question, should college students be required to take a personal finance course? Because one of the things that most college kids don't have is a real understanding of just basic personal finance, and that's true for high school students and college students. And the Wall Street Journal personal finance section does these stories where they ask a question and they have two sides, two experts that talk about why you should and why you shouldn't. And the person on the side of you should have a personal finance course, it states the obvious that it's absolutely sort of like what you just did in that article, go through those things that make it important for you to understand how you need to manage your financial affairs to make sure that you have the wherewithal to deal with any type of unforeseen event, whether you have enough money to retire, and understand what an insurance policy is, to understand the best saving, to understand what the best mortgage is, and to understand what the best investment vehicles are. On the other side, the article talks about...
I got to interrupt here. The other side is, like, so ridiculous. I can't even believe she wrote it.
But she did write it, and... It's really sort of, I guess, very similar to the whole political debate we have where, you know, we understand one side, not the other side. I don't understand this answer either. But the answer was that why focus on financial literacy? There are so many other more important things that could affect a person's life, like health, like government policies about health care. So it's not that important. And I don't quite understand that.
Well, that's like an argument of... Well, there are so many things that everyone should know that they shouldn't, that you just shouldn't bother knowing anything. Mm-hmm. I think financial literacy gives people independence. So there's nothing like it, you don't get people out of poverty more than by giving them a job and giving them money, and so, or having them make or earn money. And so if they earn that money and it alleviates a poverty life, if they don't know what to do with that money or how they should manage, even to balancing a checkbook, I just don't understand why you wouldn't to have a personal finance class. I honestly believe it should be mandatory at the high school level. And then, you know, maybe college is a little different because you're paying for college and you pay by the credit at most institutions. So it makes it a little bit harder to make it a mandatory. But really, a high school, you should be able to graduate from high school and have basic personal finance.
And one of the problems, I taught a finance course to young teens for the last few years, and I would go back after the year, and I found very little retention, and I was wondering what I was doing wrong. And there was, I think, a University of Michigan study on all of the financial literacy courses that were given to high school students, and what they discovered was none of them work. And one of the issues with any learning, and particularly something as esoteric as financial financial knowledge, is that you need to continue to practice it.
Well, absolutely. It's not a one-stop shop. It's something that, you know, you start in elementary school understanding the differences between the different coins that we have and currency, you know, our currency, and what is a $1 bill differ from a $100 bill. You really need to have a course that builds on itself, and it needs to be a financial literacy course that starts in, say, first grade and goes all the way through high school. And then from there, you can evaluate, has that really made an impact, and should there be a college mandatory too?
So the article should have discussed not whether or not we should have financial literacy, but whether we can find a way of having a financial literacy standard that actually works. You're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be back with our final segment.
For prospective homebuyers, one of the most important steps of the loan process is getting clear and honest information from someone who will speak plainly and truthfully about loan programs and options.
Hello, I'm Kelly Marsh, the branch manager of Broadview Mortgage in Santa Barbara, where our highly skilled and experienced team takes great pride in helping clients obtain home financing with honest, knowledgeable, fast, friendly, and efficient service. As a Santa Barbara area native who has spent the past 19 years in the mortgage industry and has closed over 4,000 loans, I'd appreciate the opportunity to earn your business and invite you to visit BroadviewSB.com or call my office at 805-563-1100 to learn more about how Broadview Mortgage can help you determine the best way to manage mortgage debt to achieve a more stable financial future.
Licensed by the Department of Business Oversight under the California Residential Mortgage Lending Act, license number 813G136, NMLS number 170528, an equal housing lender.
In the Santa Barbara community alone, one in every four people will have a mental health condition this year. Unfortunately, only a fraction of those who experience a serious mental illness, such as depression or bipolar disorder, will seek treatment or support. For over seven decades, the Mental Wellness Center has been responding to the critical needs of people in the Santa Barbara community and their families who are impacted by mental illness, providing support, education, and direct services. We believe that early intervention is key and that recovery is possible at any stage. Mental health is a community matter that affects us all. And that's why we're so committed to building a community of wellness and creating hope for a brighter future. In honor of Mental Health Awareness Month in May, step up for your own mental health. Visit mentalwellnesscenter.org to learn more. That's mentalwellnesscenter.org.
Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Arlington Financial Advisors, a leading wealth management firm founded on providing thoughtful, objective, and comprehensive financial guidance for families and entities who are seeking long-term financial confidence.
Yes. If you have any questions, feel free to give us a call. Our number is 564-1290 if you have any questions for Neil or myself on Money Talk.
The next article is entitled Accounting Blurs Profit Picture. And one of the things that has made investing more and more difficult is that years ago, you would look at various metrics like the price earnings multiple. And you would say over the last 10 years, the S&P 500 was selling at 17 times latest 12-month earnings, and now it's selling at 18 times or 16 times, and have some way of gauging the expensiveness or cheapness of the stock market. But now companies have begun to create earnings other than generally accepted accounting earnings. And the excuse for this is that some companies claim that the generally accepted accounting rules don't provide the right information to give an investor a true sense of how the company is doing. So, for example, in a real estate company that has a high dollar amount of depreciation, you're, in their view, penalizing the company for what is essentially the accounting requirement to expense each year life of a building that may last for many, many more years. Or in the case of any company that has a lot of capital expenditures, you shouldn't be necessarily focused on depreciation or amortization of debt and capital expenses because they're going to be used for future earnings. Well, the problem with that is that companies have begun to highlight and give prominence to non-generally accepted accounting earnings. And so when talks about a company's earnings per share and multiple of earnings per share, sometimes they're not looking at apples and oranges, or they are looking at apples and oranges rather than apples and apples. And so one of the things that's really important is that when you're looking at a company's valuation, you need to make sure that the standards are being used that are going to permit you to actually compare those earnings to other companies in that industry and other companies in general. That was so interesting. You have no comments?
You love talking about GAAP. Accounting principles.
Yeah, GAAP is an old friend.
An old frenemy, I would say, for you.
An old friend.
Yes. Well, the next article we're going to talk about is the mental mistakes we make with retirement spending. And it's the first paragraph of this article is great. Imagine spending a lifetime acquiring habits that offer the promise of a longer, happier, and more fulfilling life. Then imagine that to have that fulfilling life, you must suddenly abandon all of those habits. It's not easy, is it?
Well, I can't, we're going to run out of time in a second, but I have to tell you, I can't give up any of my habits, so forget about those habits.
But basically what this article is saying is that people who are really great at retiring, saving during their working time, have a really hard time in making that transition. And so part of it is making sure that you're living the best life that you can in retirement, as opposed to just making it all about saving every nickel and dime. So go on that cruise if you have the financial wherewithal, and do the things that bring true enjoyment to your life.
Well, we have to hurry up. I have to go get an expensive lunch. thank you so much for being our guest, and thank me for being our guest.
Thank you,
listening,
Neil,
to Money Talk on AM 1290
Have
KCSB,
a great week.
And we'll be back next week.
It's